Welcome to the ABCDA podcast, episode 6. I'm your host, Ruchira Tripathi, and you're listening to Career Journeys. My co-host, Felicity Brown, is here with me as well. Hi, Felicity.
Hi, Ruchira.
We all know 2024 is a year of international sports, and we just finished a very thrilling Olympics. And by the time this episode reaches you, we will be done with the Paralympics as well. And in keeping with the theme, our guest today is Daniel Lee. Daniel is a para-athlete who's represented Malaysia in the Asian Paralympic Games. He is a TEDx speaker and quite a change maker. Daniel, we're so excited to have you with us today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ruchira, and nice to see you too, Felicity.
We know that you are a para-athlete, but other than that, could you tell us a little bit about the exciting work that you do?
So I am a para-athlete, as you mentioned. I'm a motivational speaker and I'm a social impact leader. I started a social enterprise called 360 All Ability, which has the vision of seeing a more inclusive world for people with disabilities. So I use different things such as sports, arts, music, and other mediums to have an avenue to promote the inclusion of people with disabilities in within our societies.
When you say inclusion for people with disabilities, what kind of work is your organization doing around that?
So one of the things that I experienced as someone growing up with a disability is that the idea of the term out of sight, out of mind comes into play. And that when I was younger and I was in Kuala Lumpur, where I am, I just came to Kuala Lumpur to study in college. I don't really see people like me around. So I use a wheelchair. I was born with a condition called osteogenesis imperfecta, which is another word for brittle bones. And because of that, I've been breaking bones my whole life. Mostly on my legs, but it affects my whole body. And because of that, I stopped walking at quite a young age and been using a wheelchair ever since. And I realized that there are not that many people in wheelchairs in shopping malls or in public whenever I went out. And I realized that one of the most important things to do to improve the inclusion of people with disabilities is to bring the community into public spaces, into sight, and for people to be able to see that, hey, we do exist. 16% of the world's population has some form of disability. And 16% doesn't sound like a lot. Imagine like a whole pizza, 16% probably, yeah, you can't really imagine that's a lot, but sometimes people don't really realize that 16% is one out of every six people. So you just look around us, we don't really see that statistics being represented. So one of the many things that I do is to organize sporting events and other activities where people with disabilities are able to join us in a public space. And it's not just purely for people with disabilities. It is what we call an all-ability event where the focus is the inclusion of people with disabilities, but it does involve everyone of all types of abilities.
Wonderful. Tell us a little bit about your childhood, Daniel. You grew up in Malaysia. What was your childhood like?
I am one of three children. I'm the middle child. I have two sisters. I grew up in a place called Mentakap Pahang, which is a couple of hours from the capital city, Kuala Lumpur, where I am now. Like I said, I was born with osteogenesis imperfecta, or OI for short, and that means I break bones easily. So you imagine just seeing a child running around, learning how to walk, and they'll fall quite often. So every time I fell, there was a high risk of me breaking bones. My two sisters have the same condition. My father had the same condition. My grandfather had the same condition. So it runs in the family. Among my siblings, I am the only one in a wheelchair. My two sisters walk normally. They just have to watch out not to fall or have any kind of impact that might break their bones easily. And the reason why I'm the only one in a wheelchair, I always like to say that it's because I'm the living embodiment of the phrase, boys will be boys. So I tend to be more mischievous, be more active, even when I shouldn't. PE classes were quite tough as a kid in school, not because I was forced to participate, but rather I wanted to be a part of it, and my teachers in school would not allow it because I break bones easily. So it was tough because I would, every time there's PE, my classmates would change into sports attire, they'll run out to the field to play, and I have to stay in class and watch through the window, and that's like an hour a week. And I've been breaking bones my whole life, so much so that I stopped walking at the age of 3. And I have no memory of myself standing up or walking as a kid. I only saw pictures of myself doing that. And we grew up in a rather low-income family. And so my mom had to be at home all the time because I break bones if I'm not being watched. My dad taught English tuition, mainly from home. So we struggled a bit financially. And because of that, we couldn't afford a wheelchair. So my mom had to carry me in her arms from the ages of 3 all the way to about 10. So imagine going to school and you have kids who could sometimes be quite mean, and you are carried into class by your mom like a baby. And that was until 10 years old. But when we could afford my first wheelchair at the age of 10, I felt a kind of freedom that I never felt before. Most people would see a wheelchair as a symbol of limitation, and they see someone in a wheelchair and feel sorry for them. For me, the wheelchair is a symbol of freedom because it allowed me to finally go where I wanted to go somewhat independently. So I love my wheelchair, and I grew up just be able to go to regular mainstream school. My parents always fought for me to do well in my education, and I did pretty okay. I went to college and majored in counseling and psychology. Yeah, I didn't really go out much as a kid because I never thought I could do anything physical. So when kids would go and play, I would be at home with a family. I would study, I would daydream, I would watch TV, all sorts of things. So never really got into sports as a kid until much later in life.
So, as a child, what kind of interests did you have if you were mostly at home? How did you entertain yourself?
I watch a lot of TV. So I think some people around me would comment that my English is pretty okay, and they say, "Do you speak English at home?" Not really. I spoke a mix of Cantonese and English mishmash together when I was a kid. But I watch a lot of American shows and TVs, and that sort of helped me build my vocabulary and things like that. I say I daydream a lot. So I would imagine scenarios as a kid, because kids would imagine things and play, right? The difference is that I couldn't really physically imagine myself as a superhero and jump off a ledge or something, right? For me, I just imagine it. So a lot of daydreaming, playing with toys and figurines and Power Ranger toys and stuff like that. So yeah, I daydream a lot. I watch TV. Yeah, so sort of keep yourself entertained.
Right. You mentioned that you went on to do psychology. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on the topic of career. When did you start thinking about it? Did you start thinking about it in high school? Was there some kind of a progression towards psychology? How did you ultimately decide essentially that that's what you want to get into?
So about a couple of years before I finished high school, I started thinking about the potential of college or university, and I started thinking about what I would potentially like to do in the future. And although I didn't really have a clear idea, I knew I wanted to work with people instead of machines or computers or anything number related. So I didn't do well in math. I went to psychology thinking that I could avoid math, but It is not true because it is a research subject, so a lot of
Yeah.
statistics and stuff like that. So, oh man, I couldn't avoid it. But yeah, I knew I wanted to work with people. And so psychology was what I thought would be the best because even when I come out from psychology, I could work in marketing, I could work in HR, I could work as long as I'm working with people, even if the career is not psychology based, I could use the skills I learned. So it was around 2 years before I was graduating that I thought about the path, the career path, potential career path.
And then, so did you ever do a job in the area of psychology? Or so what happened essentially after you finished your degree, or was it your diploma?
The slight complicated aspect of it is that when in Malaysia, colleges don't give out degrees, so they have to twin and partner with a university. And typically for my program, it was a university in the UK. So I did 4 years of counseling and psychology. So I got a diploma and an advanced diploma. But an advanced diploma is in some countries pretty much equal to a degree
Yeah,
because we study
yes.
the same amount of time, we do our research paper. But because of accreditation, they couldn't give out a degree. So I had to go to UK for 3 months if I wanted a degree. And it was around that time where I decided that was not what I needed. So I actually, right now, I have an advanced diploma, which is equivalent to a degree, but in Malaysia, it's not really recognized as a degree. I was also offered an opportunity to skip that UK degree program and go straight into a master's from my advanced diploma. But I wasn't planning to go into a professional career in psychology. So I knew I didn't need that and come back with a five-figure debt, student debt.
Okay. So after you completed your advanced diploma, did you actively enter into some kind of a job, or did you directly transition into a different kind of a career?
I knew on my first week in college that I would not want to be a professional psychologist or counselor. I knew that a life as a professional therapist or psychologist is probably what I may not want to do. It's not something I want to do. And so even while I was in college, I was preparing and thinking about what I want to do after college. And especially when I did not want to pursue the 3 months degree program in the UK. So what could I do? And really, that was when the idea of being a motivational speaker came into play. And I thought about if I don't have an official degree certification, what I still need a portfolio of sorts, depending on the career. And as a motivational speaker, if I don't have a degree, then what do I do? And that's also when the idea of sports came to mind. But right after college, I actually started a couple of things at the same time. I started a journey to become a motivational speaker. So that's when I started looking for opportunities to speak. But my first job right after college is with a nonprofit organization that uses runs as a way to impact and inspire the community. So we organize runs to empower people to start thinking about Malaysia and making a difference in Malaysia. And also we raise funds from the funds to support underprivileged families.
I see. So you did that for some time.
Yes. I did that for around almost 3 years before I decided that on top of just speaking and inspiring people, I wanted to play a direct role in nurturing leaders. So around that time, I decided to apply for a job in a leadership development company. And from there, for a couple of years, I was with them, mainly with the job role of organizing leadership camps and empowering youths to become leaders.
Why do you think that is something that's so attractive for you, which is to develop the leadership skills or abilities in youth?
So when I was younger in school, I never held any leadership roles, never thought I could be a leader or hold any position of authority. In fact, when I was around, I would like to say around 10 or 11, I actually approached my teacher in school and I asked if I could become a school prefect because in Malaysia, the prefects will have a different uniform. So it's pretty cool. And I asked him, hey, do you think I could become a school prefect? And he said, okay, it's not probably not the best for you just because prefects have to go everywhere. And so you being in a wheelchair is pretty tough. So I asked, how about a librarian, which also had a different uniform? And he said, no, the library is upstairs. And then I asked him, how about a class monitor? And he just got so fed up with me and he said, nah, I don't think leadership roles are made for people like you. So my teacher actually said that. And so I never believed in myself enough until I got to college. I joined a club. I joined the Christian Fellowship in while I was in college. And from there, the president of the Christian Fellowship Association, the CF, basically saw potential in me and nurtured me as a leader and gave me my first role as a leader in the form of a facilitator in a discussion group. And it took her 1 month to convince me to even take on that role. And I saw the impact a mentor and a person who believes in you have in your life. And that has always stayed in my heart. And when I became a motivational speaker, I wanted to inspire change and inspire people to pursue their dreams and their potential in life. And so as I do more of that, I realized I want to be more involved in having a direct impact in mentoring, nurturing someone as a leader. And that was really the idea that stuck with me, the impact a mentor has in someone's life, especially when they're young, and how you could potentially change the person's life by just empowering them to fulfill their potential.
Question for you, Daniel, and I loved what you just said and how challenging it was. You wanted to be a leader from when you were young, and unfortunately, you were given all the messages that wasn't for you. So great that you were able to do that and become a motivational speaker. And I'm really interested when you said the journey to become a motivational speaker. I don't know if there's any set career progression around achieving that. I would like to hear more about how you did manage it, becoming a motivational speaker.
When I was in college, I couldn't imagine myself doing public speaking. I couldn't speak in a group of five even. But as like I said, that the president of the CF who nurtured me as a leader gave me opportunities to lead and at some point became the vice president of the Christian Fellowship. In my second year, I realized that whenever I spoke, people listened. And that sparked something in me and got me thinking maybe I have some sort of a talent or gift in speaking. And so I started speaking while I was in college in small groups and in churches who wanted to get me in to encourage the youth. But as I graduated from college, I wanted to do it more intentionally. And so I started building a portfolio, a one pager of my profile and my experiences. It was around the time that I got into sports as well. And I'll tell you more how I got into sports later. I got into marathon running with my wheelchair. So I started with 10 kilometer to 21 half marathons to full marathons. And at some point I did a 100 kilometer ultra marathon to raise funds for charity for a local school in Malaysia. And really building a portfolio, because I think a lot of times when you think about a career path, you think about the certifications that you need as a degree or a master's or a PhD. I knew that I wasn't pursuing the 3 months in the UK. Technically, I don't have a degree and therefore would be disadvantaged. And therefore, in my mind, I have to build a different kind of CV. I got into sports partially because I wanted to challenge myself physically, mentally, emotionally, and see how far I could go. But at the same time, I wanted to inspire people. So whenever I would join a run, people are inspired and I encourage them. So I use that as part of my quote unquote CV, my resume, all the runs that I've done, and really the turning point of the 100 kilometer that I did. It allowed me a portfolio that not many people have. Someone growing up with a disability who to whom sports is virtually impossible. But I overcame that and am using that to inspire people. And so really it is thinking about the portfolio and your resume based on the career that you have. So not just blindly following the path of getting a degree or a PhD just because everyone's doing it, but being intentional in getting those qualifications and milestones as part of boosting your career path. So as a motivational speaker, I use sports as a way not to just to challenge myself, but to as my portfolio. And I just had the opportunity to speak to schools and from schools to universities. And from universities to getting my first corporate engagement. And now I speak constantly to corporate companies and some of the biggest companies in Malaysia.
It's interesting you talk about portfolio because actually in career speak, there is a term called portfolio career, and where you have many skills and interests and you're able to monetize them in a way that suits your lifestyle. That's how we define it. But so that's what you have going on right now. You have what a lot of people call a portfolio career. But when you had completed your diploma, did you at that point think that this is the kind of career you wanted, or it over the years things flowed naturally and this is where you ended up with, where you have different areas that you are working in, you're interested in all of them, and each area flows into the other. So how did you think about getting to the portfolio career that you have right now?
I think I never intentionally tried to approach it that way, right? I knew since I was young, I just have different interests. I like being a jack of all trades and hopefully master of some. And I tend to get bored very easily when I do one thing. So I used to jump from things to things. And I tend to be quite good at what I do if I'm interested in it. As I was graduating and thinking about a career path, I think the approach is looking at a purpose instead of what I want to do. Looking at the why rather than the what. And I don't know who taught me that, but somehow I thought of it that way. I wasn't specifically thinking about what job I would have, but rather how can I actually make a difference in the world? And the why and the purpose was there. And that got me into motivational speaking, sports. And my first job while I was still doing motivational speaking and sports was with a nonprofit. And that was simply because I saw the kind of impact I could make through that organization by inspiring people to run and to raise funds through their runs to impact local communities in Malaysia. And even then, after that organization, where I went to a leadership development company and decided to be more involved in nurturing leaders, that was also very purpose and vision based. It wasn't so much a career progression as I was trying to see it. I wasn't thinking about what should I do now, what can I do next, and all, but rather, what is it that I want to achieve and the kind of impact I want to make? And because of the impact I want to make and the kind of personality I have in just being interested in different things, it got me into different areas in life. And most recently, starting my own social enterprise to be able to not just sustain it as a business, but to have an actual impact within the community in Malaysia, especially with the community of people with disabilities. And so that is a rather new venture and new milestone in my path. And that wasn't because of the idea of, okay, you've done everything in this area, so it's time for you to start your own company. So it wasn't that way. It was more, okay, I've made impact in these areas and I want to continue to make a greater impact within the communities with people with disabilities. So what do I need to do that? And more, the more I saw it, the more I realized I needed a company and a business that can actually have that kind of influence and impact in Malaysia. And so even though I hated the idea of starting my own company, I do a lot of things that are quite entrepreneurial, but sometimes I don't see myself as an entrepreneur. So I never wanted to touch the idea of starting my own business. But because of the impact I want to make, I decided this is the step that I need to take to actually progress.
I'm really interested in all those things you just said, Daniel, and I'm reflecting and I'm thinking back to my parents' time. You had one career for life back then, and then in my generation, often we worked to get financially secure, and then later in our careers, we're able to follow our meaning and purpose. And perhaps hopefully leave a legacy. But within you, this is something that the purpose-driven meaning side has really driven you. Sounds like actually since pretty young. So I want to go back thinking about what that teacher told you that turned you away, you thought from leadership that wasn't possible. What's inside you that drives you like this to go and achieve all of these things and inspire people and make a difference?
I think my parents played a big role, especially my dad. I lost my dad to a heart attack when I was 14. But before he passed on, I think he did quite a good job in laying down the foundations of who I am today in terms of my character and my principal beliefs. And my father had always pushed me to grow and to push beyond my limitations. And for example, it's pretty typical for an Asian household to just push your kids to get straight A's, right? For me, my dad was different. For example, I wasn't good with math or history. And so I would get, let's say, a C or a B. History is just barely passing. And my dad would try to push me from a C to a B and constantly trying to push me to challenge myself. But for example, in subjects like English, where I would score highest in class most of the time, then he expects a certain level of standard. So I would, for example, score typically 92 to 96 points out of 100 in my English exams. And one day I got an 86, 84, 86, and still highest in class. But my dad asked, "What's wrong?" I said, "Nothing's wrong. I'm like the highest in class still." He said, "Yes, I know, but it's not your standard." So 84, 86 was not your standard in English. But math is like 65. So he would try to get me to push me to 70, 75, and 80. And so just really having an early role model of pursuing your potential, not allowing circumstances to dictate your outcome in life. So my dad would instill in me the idea that I may be different, but you still have the potential to succeed. You just have to work harder in certain areas or do it differently. So he knew that I wouldn't be able to do manual or hard labor. I couldn't even do things like being a server in a restaurant. So he has always share with me how important education is. And if you don't focus on education, then you have to struggle in life like we did, he said. Because he dropped out from school in what we call Form 3, which is like high school, middle school. So 3 years into secondary school. And the reason why he dropped out was because, like me, he couldn't walk and he didn't have a wheelchair at that time. and his friends had to carry him everywhere in school. And he felt like a burden, felt like a failure. And so he decided he was embarrassed and he didn't want to go to school anymore. And my grandfather allowed that because they came from a time of where for an Asian family or a Chinese family, it is pretty embarrassing to have a child with a disability. So when my dad said, "I don't want to go to school anymore," he said, "Okay, good." And so my dad struggled because he didn't complete school. He taught himself English, bought books and all those, and started teaching tuition. And so we struggled a little bit and said, "Hey, if you don't want a hard life like us, do study hard." And so for me, having role models early on in life in the form of my parents and understanding, seeing the impact a mentor have in my life, all those things got me thinking about the things that I want to achieve in the form of the legacy and the leave behind. So, like you say, it is true. Our parents' generation, our grandparents' generation always approach it from the point of view of let's work really hard so that we can have a decent life or survive. And when I have done enough later on in life, we'll try to make a difference and leave a legacy. So I believe they came from a different generation. And I am very privileged to be in this generation where I don't have to constantly think about what can I do to survive. Of course, there are things like that still today. But we come from a time where right now you could basically make an income in any areas as long as you have the right strategies. No one would think 30 years ago that you could just make silly videos online and be a millionaire. But I'm now in a generation where as long as I have the right strategy and I work hard, I'm able to sustain a living and actually probably thrive in any areas that I am interested in. So I don't believe that I need to segregate that, at least for me. I think a lot of people still believe in working hard, earning income. When you do well in life, then later on, try to leave a legacy. But for me, I know that life is uncertain. I'm not saying this in a negative way, but we could die anytime. And I have three close friends. Two of them I've outlived. So two of my friends has passed away in their 30s, early 30s. And so I've already outlived two of my closest friends. But one of them was my strength and conditioning coach. I did boxing for a while as well, just for fun with brittle bones, greatest idea in the world. But he coached me in boxing. He started me off when I was pursuing the Paralympics as an athlete. And he started me off teaching me how to train at gym. And so his name was Chris. And he had such a profound impact in the lives of his students that when he passed away, I saw many people coming to his funeral. And actually, a lot of people couldn't come because it was COVID, but it was an online wake service kind of thing. And people talked about the impact that he had in their lives, in empowering them to be more confident, to try out things they never tried before. And I knew that I cannot live thinking that for sure I will live up to we're 60 to 70 to 80 years old, which is a good thing to have. But I live my life thinking that I could one day not be here anytime. And so what can I do to actually leave an impact while I'm still here so I don't have to wait till I'm retired before I'm trying to make a difference.
Tell us a little bit, Daniel, about how sports entered your life. Why did you decide to get into Paralympics and do the ultra marathons that you were talking about earlier?
Like I said, I've always been an active child. I always liked the idea of being an athlete, even though to me at that point in time, I couldn't see how that was possible. So I gave up on that. It was around the end of 2011. It was almost Christmas time. A local church group in KL were engaged with my Christian fellowship in college quite often that time. And it was around Christmas time, and they have this project where they want to bless someone within their community for Christmas. They saw that my wheelchair was pretty beaten up. I was using my wheelchair for all sorts of things, and I was rough with it. I was speeding on the tar road and drifting with it and things like that. And so it was pretty beaten up, and they decided that they wanted to bless me with a new wheelchair. And they got me an active or a sports wheelchair. With that wheelchair, I thought the possibility of joining runs and marathons as now possible, because I've always wanted to challenge myself, see how far I could go physically, mentally, emotionally, and I like the challenge. I also believe that there are plenty of things that we could learn from sports, for example, in marathon running that can be applied to life. And so for me, it was that personal challenge. And then I got into my first run, did my first 10K in 1 hour, 4 minutes. The moment I stopped, everything spun around me and I had cramps all over my body. So I decided I want to do better. The next round, I did my 10 kilometer, I finished it in 45 minutes. And from there, really, I saw the potential I had in sports, so specifically wheelchair racing. And I asked around and see if there's any opportunity for me to join a team. And I had the same answer everywhere. They said, no one's doing wheelchair racing, choose a different sport. I was pretty disappointed. But one day, my friend introduced me to the sport of sitting volleyball. So sitting volleyball is not done in a chair, it's done on the floor. I wasn't sure about doing sports with a fast-moving ball when I have brittle bones. I tried it out and felt that I could take the impact from a volleyball and had a natural talent for it. And so I got into the state team a couple months later and represented Malaysia a year plus later on. But later I decided that I want to still pursue wheelchair racing. And so I retired from sitting volleyball after the Asian Youth Para Games. And while I was doing, and after my job with the Leadership Development Company, I quit that job to pursue the Paralympics. And as a wheelchair racer, from there, I've been pursuing it for the past few years. It's been tough. Because I've been the only wheelchair racer in Malaysia trying to pursue that sport. It's a very expensive sport, and also there's no coach in Malaysia. So I had to self-fund everything, I had to self-learn everything. I was aiming for the Paralympics this year, but could not qualify in time. And a couple of months back, I made the hard decision to reevaluate where I'm going and my goals, my Paralympic vision. And I just made the hard decision to decide to change sports. So I went from sitting volleyball to wheelchair racing to now, to have a better chance for the next Paralympics, I decided to go into wheelchair fencing. So
Fencing, did you say?
fencing with a sword. That's partially because I did boxing for a while and I like the idea of combat sports. I would not be able to do boxing competitively because at some point there's so much I can reach. There's only a certain level I can reach with my condition. And so wheelchair fencing is probably the closest thing that I can do in combat sports. And I found an association, the Malaysian Disabled Fencing Association, where they have a coach, they have a manager, they have a president of their association. So I could actually just focus on being an athlete instead of trying to be an athlete, my own manager, my own, I need to look for sponsorship, do all sorts of things on my own as a
Yeah.
wheelchair racer.
I wanted to ask a little bit about the ecosystem because when you were talking about your journey through sport and you mentioned that it's a bit of a struggle with respect to sponsorships and other things. And I was thinking when we think about athletes in especially in the popular sports, They have, apart from the earnings here and there and the sponsorships, they get, for example, brand endorsement through which they can earn or support their expenses, plan for their life after sports and stuff like that. So how is the scenario with respect to with the para athletes, when especially when we talk about the Asia or the Southeast Asian regions? Do you have an idea on that?
I think there are some sports that are supported under the national sports body. So they have a team, they have a coach, they have a program in which you could join. And so they would pay you a small sum of like an allowance every month and cover all the costs of your accommodation, food, and training. So that's an option for some sports in Malaysia. For the sports I chose, nobody is doing it in Malaysia. So there's no program, no funding put into that program for wheelchair racing and now for wheelchair fencing. I am still, although they have an association, it's a newer association and it's separate from the national sports body. So they don't really have all the funding as well. And so I, as of right now, in throughout my career as an athlete, everything has been self-funded or I had to look for my own supporters. And if I'm not a well-known athlete who has already an accolade of achievements, it would be quite hard to get branding deals that would pay you well and things like that. So I had to rely on things such as crowdfunding if I have a certain milestone or set goal. So getting the community together to support a vision and my journey to achieve a certain milestone has been my strategy. So yeah, there are some programs in Malaysia for certain sports that is established, but not for all sports.
Okay, and that's with respect to just Malaysia.
Yeah, I can't really speak for other countries, but I've spoken to some athletes in Singapore, and even they had for certain sports like wheelchair racing at some point, they had some challenges as well because it wasn't a popular sport. So I don't know what the situation is right now, but I believe it's just different in different countries.
I see. Okay. So what's next for you, Daniel?
So, a couple of things. The main thing being the 360 All Ability social enterprise that I just started. We are pretty new still, and I'm just looking at how we can grow in our impact and influence in Malaysia when it comes to improving conversations about inclusion of people with disabilities within our community. So there are a lot of things to tackle, basic things such as accessibility and the presence of people with disabilities in public. And I've also had companies approaching me about job opportunities and improving that for people with disabilities. And that is like a whole area of challenges that is totally different. Yeah, so I'm looking into really how can I be more impactful through 360 All Ability in Malaysia. And my next big goal is also as a new athlete in wheelchair fencing, I have 4 years to prepare for the next Paralympics. So my next goal would be the LA 2028 Paralympic Games in that new sport of wheelchair fencing.
Wow, that sounds exciting.
Yeah, it is.
I
I'm
have a
looking forward to
question.
it, and it'll be an uphill battle. But yeah.
Yeah, I note that you tend to take the road less traveled, which is more challenging, but you clearly have a lot of self-belief. I would like to ask you a question about thinking back on everything you've done so far in your life. You've got some great goals ahead of you too, but to date, what are you most proud of?
I can't pinpoint anything particular, but I think the 100-kilometer ultramarathon that I did was a highlight, not because of it being a 100-kilometer ultramarathon, but I think I can't really pinpoint anything in particular. But if I were to think from just the top of my head, the 100-kilometer ultramarathon is probably a highlight in what I'm really proud of, not because it was 100 kilometers, but rather it was the effort put together by different people to come together for a cause. And that time we were raising funds for a local school in Malaysia called the Dignity for Children Foundation, and really having hundreds of people coming together, running. It was my two friends and I doing 100 kilometers, but we also got 200 plus people to join at different points of the run. So some of them would run 10, 20, 40 kilometers to support us. And we raised around, in Malaysian ringgit, about 160,000 ringgit. It's roughly around maybe 40,000 USD. And that was something that I felt proud of, because we were able to come together as a community to see the power of combined efforts. And when we have a vision and a goal to make a difference, we can actually make a real change. And so we raised those funds to support the education of a group of children, a certain set number of students for that year. And yeah, I think it has always been a very memorable part of my journey, because number one, I physically, I never thought I could do 100 kilometers. Number two, really just have seeing different people coming together to go the extra mile for somebody. And that's, it has left a real lasting impression on what we could do.
We are out of time now. So, in closing, Daniel, is there any wisdom that you would want to share with young people? Things that you wish you had known as a young person when it comes to finding your purpose?
I think we need to look for a purpose bigger than just ourselves, and to look beyond just ourselves and think about the kind of impact we want to make in the world around us, and not be too pressured by what you need to do, but more why you want to do what you do. And so find that bigger purpose and take small steps toward it, and not be rushed just because people around you are seemingly moving faster or slower in life. So have a purpose bigger than yourself and work towards that, and being patient, knowing that you are not going to get there on day one. So take baby steps to get there.
Felicity, any closing comments from you?
No, I just think that those words are really inspirational. And often we are in such a rush these days and want instant gratification. So, not just the purpose beyond yourself and bigger than yourself, but just taking those small steps and I guess having some self-belief and working with others to achieve what you want to achieve, be a bit patient there. I think it's a really great message. I want to thank you so much for sharing all of that with us today. Over to you,
Thank
Rashir.
you. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a wonderful time chatting with you both, and I hope it inspires some people who's listening to this.
Yes, and we will look forward to information, more information, and the work that you're doing on 360 All Ability, your organization, the new organization that you're planning to set up and extend throughout Southeast Asia and other countries.
I
Thank you
wish
so
you all
much.
the best with qualifications for 2028 Paralympics
Yes.
in
Thank you so
wheelchair
much.
fencing.
I will
I'll be
do my
watching out
best.
for you.
Thank you.